This is, holy God, a beautiful voice chart.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a beautiful voice chart, folks.
You gotta see this.
Wow, she's calling over her partner here to check it
this
out.
Is Bill.
Bill, she's Bill calling Bill over.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I've got a top notch voice chart.
You have a
Holy
very
gosh.
Powerful,
very powerful being, hon.
Wow. Yeah. All right, nice.
Very sensitive being at the same time.
Yeah, that's so amazing.
You know, people say conferences are dead. Or certainly dying and maybe dead. They're pining for the fjords of Norway, as Monty Python would say. And I think there's some truth to that. It definitely was an older crowd at the East Coast Paracon. There were a couple of younger people, Kelly's a younger person. But by and large, I would say most people were over 40, and most were over 50 probably. But it's a good opportunity to meet people, which you cannot do online.
Right.
You can. You know, Ashley Madison. You can,
hey, but you twice. You can't, yeah, yeah.
You can't have that personal. I'm hoping my name doesn't come up. I'm pretty sure I'm low on everyone's totem pole. You can converse with people through email or even via Skype, but there's nothing like sitting down with someone at dinner or in a social setting or even at their table and having that one-on-one in-person kind of conversation with them. And that's, you can only get that by going and meeting them, usually at one of these conferences. So for everybody that says conferences are dead and the new media and the new age and all that is the way to go, there's some truth in it, but I still think there's a place for these conferences. Mm. You know, it's almost like churches. Churches should be the place where a community can come together and share stories and beliefs and fellowship. That's what they're supposed to be. They're not supposed to be giant money-making machines. I think conferences are the same thing. They shouldn't be giant money-making machines. They should be places where people can come together and hopefully not lose money, but share stories and experiences and opinions and adventures and just get to meet people. And going back to my theme about communication, maybe that's what, if the advanced non-human intelligence is interacting with us, I think it's trying to get us to see ourselves as something other than just individuals, but as part of a bigger whole. And in that sense, I think conferences are an important part of whatever that interaction is, because that's the one place where we can all get together at the same time and interact. And the same thing was true of the ghost investigation, too. You know, even on a smaller scale, it was nice to get this group of 12 or 15, whatever it was, people in this place, and, you know, you can kind of interact with each other. And I dig that. I really... maybe I'm old school, but I really like conferences. I still do. I hope to go to another one this year at some point. And you know, I guess my last word on the East Coast Para Conference, the first conference ever held in Nova Scotia on the paranormal is, if you get a chance to go next year, folks, if they do hold it next year, and I think they are, they seem to be thinking they will, then you should definitely go. Great town, great people, great show, and a little bit of everything. It's a paranormal potpourri. I highly recommend it.
Absolutely, yeah. We can go over when the lady counts us down. We can still talk for a few minutes afterwards. So don't. It's not going to cut. The live folks won't hear us, but the MP3 folks will. But we won't go too long after the hour. But yeah, that's Paul really said it best. I can't really say much more to that. Thanks to Kelly and Linda and all the folks at the East Coast Paracon. I had an amazing time, and weirdly enough, I guess not in a way, because it was a bit out of the way if you're American. I was, aside from Lauren and Chip, I was the only American there. So I was like the only American in attendance. And I'd like to change that next year, folks. Make the trip up to Canada and do this. It's an awesome event. You'll have a really good time. You'll get to meet these folks and really interact with them in a way, like Paul said, you just can't do online and get the chance to talk to them. Kelly says they're working on Paracon 2016 right now. So I will put it in my calendar once I know the dates, because I definitely want to do it again. I really, really, really had an amazing time and really enjoyed it. And I just had a blast. I really did. You know, I always worry about these events, but this time around, it really was just so much fun. So I can't thank them enough for everything. And thanks to the live listeners for tuning in. They're probably gone now, but thanks to all the folks in the chat room. This flew by, dude. this was an amazingly fast episode. So,
Zoom.
Yeah,
that's what happens when you and I chat, Tim. It's just like Zoom.
Now we managed to cover everything in the conference. I had a couple Canadian questions, though.
Oh, well, here we are. This is the Banal of America post show. So what are your Canadian questions?
Okay. This I found fascinating. I mentioned it on Facebook. You didn't post anything about it, so I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it. But at first I was like, wait a minute, it didn't even dawn on me until I noticed that they got rid of pennies in Canada,
yes.
Which is pretty cool. And I liked how it's not the honor system, but it's just sort of like a mutually agreed upon thing where it's like if it's like 56 or 57, they charge you 50, you know, they round it essentially. One way or the other, whichever way is fair. And it's like, it's just, I said on Facebook, I'm like, I don't know if that would go in America. I can totally see people being like, nah, I ain't giving you an extra 2 cents because you round up. But at the same time, people seem to be cool with it up there. And it was pretty, you know, it kind of captured in my mind the whole mood of Canada where people were like, it is how it is.
Well, pennies are, you know, we're not the only country to get rid of them.
Yeah, apparently Australia and New Zealand did too.
They're the most useless form of currency. I mean, when they did it, people were like, what are we going to do without our penny? Yeah, I don't know. First of all, your pocket's going to be lighter. And secondly, sure, round up, round down, I'm pretty sure it'll all even out. And at the end of any given year, I'm either down 10 cents or up 10 cents, but I'm pretty sure I can live without that if I'm down. So it's just a convenience thing. At some point, the prices will probably change so that you won't even have like 5.58 or whatever.
Right.
It'll all be 5.50, 5.55. But it just makes sense. So yeah, I forgot that they still have pennies in the U.S., which I just find charming in a time to grow up and move into the 21st century sort of way.
I'm in agreement. I was like, this makes so much more sense. This is awesome. And then I'm like, I wish they'd do this in America. And then the other part of me was like, I don't know if they could make that fly.
Usually when people say that about Canada vis-a-vis America, it's things like universal health care. Gosh, that makes so much sense. I wish we'd do that in America. But, you know, pennies, same thing. We have a lot of good ideas up here, you folks. You might want to take a look at.
It's a start. It's a start,
yeah.
The penny thing.
Start with pennies. There you go.
Okay, now I noticed also that, now this may have just been a circumstantial situation for me, but I noticed that people don't seem to say bless you when someone sneezes in Canada. Is that accurate, or is that just something I know that was a happenstance for me?
I'd never really thought of it. Some people do, I guess. Some people will say Gesundheit. But yeah, no, bless you, I hardly ever hear that. If anything, I'd hear Gesundheit. People might say,
I didn't hear that. I just didn't hear anyone even acknowledge sneezes. That was the weird part. So, like, I sneezed a couple times and no one said anything, and then a couple times I saw someone sneeze and I was like, bless you. But I was like the only one even who acknowledged the sneeze. It was very weird. Keep an eye on that.
I've never thought of that, but you're right. I actually, generally speaking, I don't hear people say that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, keep an eye out for that.
Except at T-Hos.
Yes, at T-Hos, they're always polite.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think it's polite not to acknowledge it. It's just like, you know, it's like, I don't want to say bless you or Gesundheit. All you did was sneeze. If you pass wind, nobody goes bless you. It's just a bodily function. So I don't know why sneezing has always been sort of singled out. It's like, yeah, that's the one we're actually going to single out and say, oh, bless you that you've sneezed. And yet I think there's some old thing where people sneezed, it was like you were sneezing out part of your soul or something.
Yeah.
And so they would say, yeah, I don't know, whatever.
It was one of those things, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the thing that stood out to me where I was like, am I noticing this or am I just going crazy? So,
yeah.
No,
you're not going crazy. I think you're probably right, actually.
And then, essentially the trip for me, then Paul, again, was amazingly gracious, drove me up to the ferry. Oh, I didn't tell the story about the Christian couple, yeah. So Paul drove me up to the ferry. I'm on the ferry from Nova Scotia to Prince Edward Island, which it's hard to explain. Prince Edward Island, it got this sort of like Cape Cod vibe from it, where it was sort of like this family, little touristy, but not like crazy touristy, but sort of like quaint touristy, beachy sort of feel to the place, pretty much. And so I'm on the ferry to Prince Edward Island, where I have family, and I'm like, as Paul can attest, because I like pretty much brought everything I was bringing on the whole trip with me. So I had like a backpack, a suitcase, another bag, a crazy straw hat that made me look ridiculous. I just look like half a bum, pretty much. And so I sit at one of these tables, and it's a four-seater, and probably, like, it was pretty crowded on that ferry. But this young couple comes over. They're, like, looking for a seat and everything. They're about to leave. So I'm just like, hey, I'm all by myself. If you guys want to sit here, that's cool. So they sit down. And at first I'm just trying not to, like, talk to them because I don't want to be intrusive or anything. But I hear the girl say sacrifice, like, 3 or 4 times, which I thought was kind of interesting. I wasn't, like, eavesdropping, but for some reason the word sacrifice would catch my ear. So eventually, it's a long ride. It's like 1 hour and 15 minutes. So eventually, we kind of start chatting a little bit, and I'm telling them about the East Coast Paracon and what I was doing there. And then the guy starts asking me about how I feel about different stuff from the Bible, essentially. Is there heaven and hell? Is there good and evil? And it turned into, like, this pretty, like, interesting sort of esoteric conversation about religion, spirituality, the revelations, all kinds of. It was really cool. It was actually really like, wow, this is a really interesting sort of conversation that I found myself getting into here on this boat. And eventually, you know, he explains that he must have been super religious because he was like quoting the Bible by verse, and he said that his wife, I presume his wife, that she was just born again like 6 months earlier. And I, believe me, folks, I'm like, I don't have a problem with anybody or doing anything. So it's like, that's fine. And he wasn't preachy or trying to, like, he was actually really apologetic at times because he would sort of challenge me on spiritual ideas, but never really wanted to, I mean, he wasn't like one of those, one of those people that protest the funerals or whatever. He wasn't like a zealot. He was just sort of an inquisitive mind. So it was just really a great conversation, great people, loved him. Now, Prince Edward Island, it's not super big, but it's, like, fairly big. And so I get off the boat. I'm riding around. I got picked up, and I'm getting driven to my aunt's place. And my aunt's place is, like, maybe, like, 1 hour and 15 minutes from where the ferry drops off. So we drive for, like, 40 minutes, right? So this isn't, like, 10 minutes outside of where the ferry came in. This isn't, like, oddly enough, I didn't mention this on Facebook because it's just kind of even more ridiculous. But you'll appreciate this, Paul. You get off the ferry, there's several different kind of buildings and shit, and there's different parking lots and stuff, and I really had to go to the bathroom, but since I had everything I owned with me, I couldn't do that on the ferry, so I dump all my stuff in the car, and I go into, like, what looks like a terminal, and I go into the bathroom, and there at the bathroom is the Christian dude. So it was like a triple synchronicity. So that was kind of like, oh, that's weird, but I'm at the ferry terminal, so it's not that big a deal. So then we drive for like 40 miles, and I want to get out and go into a grocery store because I'm still under the delusion that I'm in New Hampshire or something and I can just go into any store and buy alcohol. So I'm like, I just want to grab a six-pack to unwind from this very long day. So I walk into the grocery store, which is a big store, folks. It's like a Wegmans or a Stop and Shop or an Atlantic Superstore. I think it was an Atlantic Superstore up there. I walk in, take maybe 10 steps into the produce section, and walk right into this dude's wife. And I actually was like, first thing, I just looked at her, I was like, we got to stop meeting like this. And she laughed, and I laughed, and then I wandered around, and some young kids tried to explain to me that I couldn't get beer there, and was trying to send me someplace else to get it, and anyway, and then I found the dude, the husband, and I said, you know, sort of said to him, I just told your wife, we got to stop meeting like this, this is crazy. And he was like, yeah, this is really weird. So it was really odd. It was really odd. It was just seemed like to me, you know, what are the odds? You know, just really, really, just to me it seemed like really odd. I keep saying that, but that's the best word I can come up with. The synchronistic, the chances of just the one grocery store I stop at, like 40 minutes, 40 miles away, turns out to be the same one they go to. Very weird.
Well, I could potentially pour cold water on that, but probably not. I mean, it is weird. It's a little odd. You must have been at the superstore on the road leading into Charlottetown.
I'm sure. Yeah. But I guess that we both ended up going to the grocery. I mean, not just that it was a grocery store. I just mean that we both ended up same store, same time.
Because there are other. There's other supermarkets, large and small, that they could have gone to. Yeah, it's a little weird. There's no question. Especially as they were the two people that you chose to talk to on the boat, and there, you know, is a slight paranormal connection there.
Yeah.
In the conversation. So, yeah. Now, if you had seen them the next day, that would have been even weirder.
I know. I thought about that. Yeah, I kind of kept a lookout for them.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing about synchronicity, right? Once, as Walter would say, once you have it happen to you, you start looking for it.
Hmm.
And then, you know, you start to realize that it's potentially all around you all the time. So you become more aware. So maybe that was just them, you know, something trying to make you aware of things around you. So it'd be interesting. Walter's thing would be, did you have any other weird experiences, synchronistic experiences after that, Tim? And did any of them involve the number 9?
Oh, not that I know of.
Oh, okay.
Not that
well,
I know of.
Well, then it's just a coincidence. That's sorry. There's my Walter Posley impression. It's just a coincidence. No, who knows? It's weird. It's definitely a weird story.
So that was kind of the biggest, the weirdest.
Or you're a stalker.
That's what someone else said, yeah. Someone's like, you're
stalking. Probably listening. Yeah, the Christian people are probably listening to this going, no, the stalker guy. Yes, we remember him. Yeah.
I just hope, I didn't just say this, I didn't joke about this on Facebook, but given my resemblance to a young Jesus, I just hope it didn't have any, you know, I hope it didn't affect them too badly. You know what I mean? I've got the long hair, I've got the beard, I'm sort of like this wayward traveler who let them sit next to them on the boat. They were probably like, what do you think that was? What do you think happened there?
I got news for you. Jesus died at 33. You would be the older Jesus.
I could pass for 33.
Well, that wouldn't make you young Jesus, though. You'd have to be like 23 to be young Jesus. I don't see you passing for young Jesus.
Maybe they thought I was an angel.
I'm just trying to imagine you showing up at, you know, on the Sea of Galilee, or everybody thinking you're going to walk on water. And you go, hey, where can I get a 6-pack and some cigarettes? Anybody? Anybody at all? They just look at you strange. You're Jesus. Can't you make your own alcohol? And you'd be like, whoa, yes, absolutely, I can. Give me some water. And off you go.
Oh, man, yeah. So that was the weird synchronicity. Then as far as the rest of the trip goes, there's not much for me to say. I hung out with family, spent time with them, enjoyed incredible meals. I'm willing to bet that you're not a poutine fan.
Love poutine.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Figured you'd have a hard line stance against it for
it's
some
reason. It's gravy. Love gravy.
Yeah.
It's French fries. Love all forms of potatoes. And it's curds or cheese if you make it improperly, like mozzarella or something. Love cheese. So putting all three of them together, it's Canada's gift to the world.
It's really outstanding. I loved it. So I had poutine. I ate a lot of seafood. The good thing, I know anyone who's sort of like, I don't know what it's like or in the rest of the country, but like around here, because it's relatively close, you go to a restaurant, you can get PEI mussels. Obviously, on Prince Edward Island, they're just plentiful. And I actually went to a restaurant that had, they said it's like the island's longest salad bar. And at first you're like, what the hell, salad bar? But part of the whole salad bar is like dessert and all-you-can-eat PEI mussels. So it's just these people bringing out vats of PEI mussels over and over and over again. I literally, dude, I had to have eaten over 100 PEI mussels.
Wow.
I went up 4 times and covered my plate. And I had lobster, which you're not a fan of lobster, though.
I hate mussels and I hate lobster.
You hate mussels, too.
I do. Yeah. Uh-huh. But you've discovered these are secret. These seafoods are plentiful here. It's like lobsters, you were telling me, or I was telling you, and you were saying I should mention on the show, and we just forgot.
Yeah.
So here in the after chat, lobsters, what you used to, years ago, you used to be able to tell who the really, really, really poor kids were in maritime towns, usually fishing villages, because they would be the ones who would bring lobster sandwiches to school to eat, because that's what poor people ate. Because it was so plentiful, and most people considered it like the bottom feeder of the ocean. Ugh, nobody would ever eat a lobster, blah. You know, you eat fish and stuff, blah, lobster. So, you know, hey, look, there's little Johnny. What's he got for lunch? Oh, cheese whiz. Okay. What's Frankie got? Peanut butter. Hey, what's little Stevie got? He's got a lobster sandwich. Oh, Stevie, you're beneath welfare. That's where you are. And, this great scam that we managed to pull on the rest of the world, by like the South Africans and whatever, controlling the supply of diamonds, you know, controlling the supply of lobster, that it's this great delicacy when, in fact, they're these bottom-feeding, ocean-dwelling crustaceans that are basically the pigs of the ocean. They
walk around. Yeah, it's weird. I couldn't believe it when you told me that. But my aunt confirmed it later in the trip. So.
Yeah, like they used to feed it to prisoners in jails here in Nova Scotia, too. And it wasn't a way of saying, oh, it wasn't like, you know, the Donald Trump kind of prison, if Trump ever went to prison, the white-collar prison.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're in here for murdering your entire family. Here's some lobster. No, cruel and unusual punishment.
Weird, yeah.
Yeah.
I said to Paul, I'm going to have to look more into this and find out, like, if there's a book or something on this. I would do a show on the Great Lobster Bamboozle, if I could find it.
The Great Lobster Bamboozle. Yeah. Well, it's not just Maritimers. I guess the guys in Maine must do it. You know, they're
in
it, too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, the only other thing I should mention is just because this kind of thing Paul would have been, wish I had Paul with me at the time, but the where my aunt lives in Prince Edward Island, and in other places too, I think I noticed, but probably not in Halifax, I didn't even look, but like there's just no, I live in like in the suburbs of Boston, folks, and like there's just such, I never realized how bad like the light pollution must be, because when I was up on Prince Edward Island, if you look up in the sky, it was like layers upon layers of stars. It was absolutely breathtaking. It was just unbelievable stuff. I mean, if I lived up there, I probably would just sit outside and just look up at the sky all the time because it was just so amazing to see.
You would, except at night on Prince Edward Island, the poisonous spiders come out, and you don't want to be outside.
The mosquitoes were terrible. That was true.
Oh, right. That's mosquitoes. What we called them. I call them poisonous spiders, but they're mosquitoes, yeah. Oh. They carry West Nile virus and...
What?
Yeah.
Jesus, I have a lot of mosquito bites. I'm going to... Jesus. No.
Your chances of getting West Nile virus in the Maritimes are between slim and zero.
Oh, good.
But there, every year there's, you know, a few dozen cases reported out west, and a couple, I think, in the Maritimes. But they have the potential to carry West Nile virus.
I probably would know by now. It's been a week.
And they're getting worse. Yeah, you probably would.
Jesus.
Halifax has light pollution. We're a city of 500,000, 400,000 people. So if you look up, the sky last night was purple. I was like, there's no stars. It was purple. But as soon as you get, you know, an hour outside down in a place like Liverpool, you can look up and go, oh, look, stars. And it's like being in New Mexico or the southwest of the U.S. when I first went there. Same thing. If you get away from L.A. or Albuquerque or Vegas and you get out in the desert, you can look up and you're just like, and they really do have poisonous spiders or scorpions or whatever, so you have to be careful. But
yeah.
Snakes and stuff. Mm. But if you look up, it's like, yeah, wow, this is just amazing. And
yeah, I'm sure it's like that in other parts. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Prince Edward Island, definitely. My better half, I don't know what to get. My former fiancé, who's still my best friend, with whom I still cohabitate. My best friend, Linda. Anyway, she's from PEI, and her and her sister still own their old house there, and we go over a couple times every year. She goes over a lot more than I do. And you can stand out in the backyard and just look up and go, look at that, stars. I had no idea that there were so many stars, because they're about 40 minutes outside of Charlottetown, which is a city of maybe 35,000, so even in Charlottetown you can still see a few stars.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you get up to the North Shore and the beaches and stuff. Look, I'm going to put Prince Edward Island over. But if folks, Canada's smallest province really shouldn't even be a province. There's only about 150,000 people there. But, you know, if you ever get a chance, go. Because the beaches alone are just, they're amazing.
Yeah, it was awesome. Really, really enjoyed it. So
and the land of Anne of Green Gables, too, if you're
going
to Anne of Green Gables. Yeah.
And I provided everything works out right, I think I'll be doing it again next year because I had such a good time. So it was really awesome. And again, I got to thank you, A, for coming on the show and recounting all this with me. And sort of, this definitely turned into sort of like us just sitting around jamming. I really enjoyed that. And for your just, again, indefatigable hosting while we were up in Halifax and Liverpool. You really went above and beyond, man. I appreciate it.
Think nothing of it. Sorry, like I said, I'm just sorry I couldn't hang out more in Halifax, but I was, you know, still working and stuff. But it was good to get out of the city. I really enjoyed the conference. You know, I can't put it over enough. They're great people, and you're welcome here anytime.
Thanks, buddy.
Except on Tuesdays.
And in 2017.
And yeah, don't come here in 2017. I think there's some bad shit going down in 2017. I just don't know what it is yet.
Rob Ford, Prime Minister.
Well, yeah, you know what? Wouldn't it be awesome if we had Rob Ford as Prime Minister and Donald Trump as President? It would be, and Speedy Gonzalez as President of Mexico. So like a cartoon mouse President of Mexico. Awesome. It's like, that would be,
my God.
That's a television show waiting to happen. In fact, I think that's what Trump's angling for. But that would be amazing. People are like, oh, I can't believe I would never vote for Donald Trump. I see this on Facebook, all my American friends. I go, I'd vote for him. I don't agree with a single thing he says. But I grew up in the 80s. I just think it would be really cool to have Donald Trump as president for 4 years to teach you guys a lesson on just how bad things could get.
Yeah.
You know, if you think it's bad now, it's going to get a lot worse. And a friend of mine reminded me today, he posted something on Facebook, he referenced me, and he said, yeah, I don't think we'd make it through. The problem is we might not make it through those 4 years, literally, like he might blow the planet up or something, or he might sell us, might sell the entire planet. He'd declare the entire planet bankrupt. And then,
yeah, exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Sell it to space aliens to be a reality show or something.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Well, we'll watch it all unfold over the next year, but thank you. Thank you once again, Paul, for coming on the show. I'm going to throw my plugs in now. Feel free to ride off into the sunset this evening, and we'll do it all again, I hope, in the not-too-distant future, my friend.
Sounds good, Tim. Always great talking to you, and thanks to everybody in the BOA universe for tuning in.
All right. Thanks a lot, folks. Now come the plugs. If you are wondering what exactly you just listened to, you are listening to Banal of America Audio. You can find out more from us at banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. I should say, before we go any further, stay tuned, because we're going to stick all these interviews, if they haven't been weaved into the show, they're going to be on at the end of the show. So if you're listening right now and you normally tune out during the plugs, just stick it out here. And you're going to get some Friedman, you're going to get some Lauren Coleman, you're going to get a few other fun surprises here in the post show. So stick around. If you want to find out more about us beyond Banal of America, head on over to Facebook, punch in Banal of America. That's our page. Feel free to like us, and you'll find out more about what's going on at BOA. And what you just listened to was a two-hour program, I guess, in a way, closing the book finally once and for all on our international expedition of the summer of 2015. Banal journeys to Canada and explores the world of Canada with Paul Kimball. So it was free, and it was live. And all the shows we've done this year and in our existence are live at Banal of America. So that costs money, is the point I'm trying to make. And if you could help us out with that, that would be great. There's two ways to do so. You can head on over to BOA and click the PayPal button. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation, you can do so by writing to our P.O. box, and the address for that is at Banal of America. Let me see. I can't really plug the next edition of the show just yet. I have a bunch of guests lined up and people that I need to schedule, but everything has been so topsy-turvy here for me since I returned from Canada that it's just been really difficult for me to get anything done. But I have people in mind. I just have not really gotten the chance to lock them in yet. And good shows, though, really good shows, and interesting topics that I want to explore on the program. So as always, stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook for updates on what's next from us. And with all that said, thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. Thank you to Paul for coming on the show and, again, for being just an amazingly gracious host while I was up in Canada. And now here are some of my on-site recordings from the East Coast Paracon, eastcoastparaconference.ca. That's where you can find out more from the folks at the East Coast Paranormal Conference. And help me out, folks. Don't let me be the only American at next year's East Coast Paracon. Make the trip. It's definitely worth it. You're going to get some serious FaceTime with all the speakers and the chance to do a whole bunch of interesting and unique and different things that chances are you're not going to be able to do at most other conferences. So I cannot put the event over enough. I absolutely loved it. And as I said, here now are some segments, interviews, conversations I had with various folks at the East Coast Paraconference. Enjoy. And until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.
We're under the stage now. It's very spooky. What's your name?
Barry.
I'm with Barry. he's at the event, like me, just hanging out.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
All right, here we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're here at the East Coast Paracon in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. I'm talking to my good buddy Lauren Coleman. We've been hanging out, talking a little baseball, but he's leaving soon, so I got to make sure I get the interview in. Lauren, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you here, Tom. Tim.
Did you just call me Tom? What happened there?
You want to start all over?
No, I like it. It's good. So what do you tell us a little bit about what you're doing here, the presentation, all that good stuff.
Well, I was invited to speak about Bigfoot, the Eastern Bigfoot, which specifically because of the native peoples is called Wendigo. And a lot of people, of course, always want me to talk about, did I see a Bigfoot? What Bigfoot have been seen around here and stuff like that. But what we have to look at in Nova Scotia and Eastern Canada and also Maine is there's a historical record, which doesn't mean that you're going to turn a corner of the street and see a Bigfoot crossing, you know, from your. What you're going to see is more often than not records, historical traditions, even some native art. And that's just as important to establishing there's a Bigfoot as, you know, a current sighting on YouTube or something like that.
Yeah. If anything, it's actually strengthens the case because the historical record, they're not trying to, like, you know, they're not making things up for attention, is what I mean. You know what I mean?
Exactly. In the age of YouTube and the internet, there's so many hoaxes. There's so much bad data that actually we need to get away from some of that to get better photographs, better casts, better historical records that actually validate what we're looking for. And I think that's why you don't discount the historical record as some people would and only want to go out in the woods and howl and beat on a tree with a baseball bat or something, you know.
So what's the temperature? What's the feel of Bigfoot research right now? What's going on? What's the latest?
Well, I think if you look at the whole history of the ufology and how there was in the 60s a lot of interest, a lot of fights, and then infighting, and then all of the division, you really see a correlation between that and kind of what started happening in the 80s and 90s in Bigfoot research. A lot more people got interested. There's lots of TV shows. So what does that bring in? It brings in fringe people, which I call Bigfoot contactees. You know, the people that say that they're giving donuts to Bigfoot.
Seen a lot of that now.
Blueberry, you know, muffins, whatever the menu might be. And you know, I'm not just counting that, but I want them to bring evidence. You know, once, if you're in contact with a Bigfoot family for 50 years, could you at least take one picture of them? A family picture, maybe? Or if you're, say that you're going to an area and leaving food out for Bigfoot, couldn't you take a plaster cast of a footprint?
Right.
So it's just validating all of these contacts. And a lot of the people are saying, no, we don't want to tell you where it's at because we know that you're going to go over there and kill them and stuff like that. Well, there's lots of Bigfoot researchers that really have, in many ways, aligned themselves and committed to not kill, you know, kill faction. So I think that's invalid. We don't want to take reports from people. We don't want to undermine people. We just want to make sure that science actually verifies this creature so that then you can get the protection. So I think it's like any other adventure and any other venture. The Bigfoot field right now is populated with a real continuum of fanatics, of contactees, to all the way to scientists. When I started out in 1960, there weren't any academics except for maybe one or two.
Right.
And now you can't go to an anthropology department without at least finding one or two, you know, professors. She may be interested, he may not be. But you'll find interest and open-mindedness in a lot of departments you didn't find in, you know, that middle time.
Right. Now, what about the, what do you think of the Bigfoot, like, media boom? Is it still sort of percolating? Is it kind of dying down a little bit? Because for a while it was like it was everywhere. Now I'm not sure. I don't keep as close an eye on it as you do. So what's the sort of state of that?
I think that unfortunately what's really happening is, as opposed to as opposed to it going away in terms of the physical, let's go out there, find a Bigfoot. Shows like Monster Quest, Finding Bigfoot, which really had a scientific point of view.
Yeah, I love Monster
Quest. Yeah, are really kind of disappearing, and what you're getting is a lot of fictionalized docudramas. And they're taking creatures that are found other places and putting them domestically so that they don't have to film that. Their expenses
yeah,
are low.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
And then the other part is because they think, at least the producers, directors, executive producers, think that the public wants more paranormal. They're making Bigfoot into some kind of psychic Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's also a new trend in the field. It's not so much the shows are going away, but they're changing. I don't think we'll see Finding Bigfoot after the next year, for instance. I think that that kind of has petered out. I really, believe it or not, I like the show Bigfoot Bounty.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people thought it was real gimmicky and kind of Bigfoot joined Survivor. But that gave us an insight into the researchers. And I really like investigating the researchers, understanding the people. Bigfoot may be out there, may not, but we certainly know the researchers are. And they're fascinating. You know, the hunters have all kinds of different viewpoints, different motivations, different ways of looking at the phenomena that sometimes can be as fascinating as the creatures.
Absolutely. Now, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, the big sort of thing, the big thing was like the DNA. That was the thing. It was like, see, people seemed to like put a lot of stock in it was the DNA. The DNA is going to be the key here. And that seems like that didn't go anywhere. I'm not even sure. The psych stuff seemed like it's kind of has some holes in it now. They're kind of going after the psych stuff. And obviously, you know, the whole other thing, I forget her
Ketchum.
Name. Yes, the Ketchum.
Ketchum Ketchum.
Yeah, the Ketchum debacle. That was a whole mess. So is DNA, should we just kind of like leave that to the side and you know, wait till we actually have the Bigfoot and then look at the DNA? Because it seems like maybe we're putting the cart before the horse here.
No, not at all. I actually think that the DNA phenomena is worthy of pursuing. I think that if you read the Sykes books and review them and critically like I did, what you find is that he made several mistakes. He really looked at it as a scientist, a biochemical scientist, a geneticist, but he didn't really look at it in a context of the rest of the biology. I've spoken to some biologists, and they really feel that he went halfway. And he actually made some mistakes, like saying that it was in a certain sequence for Pleistocene bear, polar bear, when in fact it was a modern polar bear. But that's incredible. Why are they finding polar bear DNA in the Himalaya? The other thing is if you read his book very deeply, as I did, he actually found some samples that showed that one of the human samples was really from Eurasia.
Yeah.
And why would that be in the American sample?
Right.
The other thing was the Pambushet finger, which is extremely interesting. Found in Nepal, really old. We knew all of that. A couple years ago when they rediscovered it and they found it, they immediately, all the skeptics and debunkers, threw it out because the sample came back human. Well, Sykes actually tested that and found out the reason it was human, it was contaminated with Peter Burns' DNA. And that's fascinating because that means that you get rid of the contamination. What is the real bone? What is the real DNA in that bone? Is it a llama? Is it a, you know, unknown primate? Is it something else? But there's lots of mysteries in the whole DNA that's still to be revealed. It's just a lot of people got scared by Ketchum, and then Sykes' stuff with his mistakes have made it really hard for people to say, well, we're going to trust DNA. Also, there's the true believer factor. All of these hair samples were sent in, and people thought immediately Sykes is going to say, it's a new primate. And it came back, you know, cow and a hairbrush and a whole bunch of stuff.
Right.
He was very truthful about, and that's where you got to start, and then eventually we'll find something.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, like, people, they sent the stuff in, then he's like, no, it's a cow, then they're like, get the hell with this guy.
Right, yeah, exactly.
They're like, he doesn't know what he's talking. He's on a mission to debunk, that
right,
kind of thing.
Exactly.
Now, give us an update on the museum. What's going on at the museum? You got a big exhibit coming soon this summer, or it's already there, I'm not sure, but you can give us an update on that, the Iceman, right?
Right. Well, today is August 8th, and actually, the museum, the Weird from Austin, Texas, is delivering today the Minnesota Iceman, and it's going to be there for 6 months.
Nice.
So that's very exciting. It's we're not increasing the admissions. We're just kind of reconfiguring the museum. Part of the agreement of getting it is no photography, so that's very hard for us. But we're doing that and committed to keeping it safe for them and insured and security and all of that. But it's a great exhibit. We got new exhibits coming in all the time. Like we got a life-size 4-foot-long model of a tassel worm from the Alps.
Saw that. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Really exciting. And other things are happening, reconfiguring, doing a little tribute to Ivan Sanderson and,
nice.
Because he was connected to the Minnesota Iceman. And then we're really exploring moving in about half a year, 9 months to another location in Portland with more space, with actual new library, research library with a little patio for study and different things like that. And we're still exploring. Well, we have a conference in January in St. Augustine, Florida, because, a lot of people don't want to be in Maine in January. So. And we don't either. So we're going to do the conference down there. It's very marine-oriented. Marineland of the Pacific, Marineland of the Atlantic, actually, started there. And it started as a film studio. But also it was connected with the discovery of the coelacanth, the giant octopus in 1896. So we're having experts from all over the world come in and talk about some of those things that are really neglected because Bigfoot gets so much attention.
Nice. All right, so that's in January. Whatever happened with the African event, that got canceled because of the Ebola, right? Are you concerned about that?
It got canceled for Ebola. It got put off because, and that's Jeff Meldrum's. We were going to be committed to that, but it really, $6,000 a person.
That's steep,
And then, their travel and all the commitment of the time to be away for a month, it just didn't, that's why we actually started doing our conference, to make it more available to North Americans and South Americans. It could get there closer. The other thing, I think, if you look at it, a lot is changing with regard to safaris in Africa. After Cecil was killed and it's not really related to what Jeff's doing, but you can see there's a shift going on. And it's kind of like the Confederate flag of Africa. There's really a lot of photography safaris are still in place, but people are really looking at things differently about Africa. And Ebola is still a danger, and other things too. And so a lot of people don't want to go.
Yeah, you take your risks down there, I think that's about it. Any thoughts on the dismal Red Sox season for the baseball fans who are listening?
Well, I can't even say this season that we can wait until next year, because it looks like the rebuilding is going to take a while. But, you and I love baseball. We'll always be Red Sox fans. And there is hope that somebody else will kill the Yankees.
That's what we got to do. I cheer for two teams, the Red Sox and whoever beats the Yankees, right?
Yes. Exactly.
All right, Lauren. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Hopefully I can come up to the – I don't know why I'm shaking your hand. We're on the radio, but
– No, I was feeling the same too.
Yeah.
Please do come to Portland. See the museum. See all the new exhibits. 10,000 items.
Absolutely. Well, I was telling somebody, I was there like the first week it opened when opened it. I still got the opening week
T-shirt. That was only 500 square feet, and since that time, we've expanded six times that in size and many, many. Because once you open, it is very much like if you build it, they will come. And the exhibits have come, the visitors have come. We're really happy.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy for you, man. I'm so happy for you. And I will definitely make the trip up there, folks. So thank you, Lauren, for doing this little interview.
Thank you, Tim.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Looking for ghosts. Looking for ghosts in the basement of a theater. All right, there you go. I'm here with Andrea Sahadeth, and she's here in the vendors section with some really interesting stuff. I posted a picture of it on the Facebook earlier, and I promised them I'd come and investigate it today. So I'm here now to check it out. So tell me a little bit about what all this is. It's some very esoteric-looking material.
It is esoteric. It's kind of neat.
So the one aspect we're doing right now is the computer will take a voice sample. You say a silly phrase, basically vowel sounds. Mm-hmm. The computer goes in and it analyzes your voice. It looks at your patterns and your physical, your energy field of your emotional state, your mental state. And it goes into a library and it says, what do you need to help let go of the stuff you're carrying? And all you got to do is listen. So the computer goes in and it analyzes a billion bits of data. It produces a pretty chart that kind of shows, you know, patterns that exist within you. And then it creates a 24-minute set of frequencies that you can choose to take home or download. And you just simply have to listen. And it's about helping us shift patterns that we have in our lives. So, you know, we always have fears or anxieties or that kind of stuff. So it helps dump that stuff without having to necessarily go through talk therapy or any of that kind of stuff. You just got to listen. And they're weird. I mean, they're not musical. They're like, wah, tiki, 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 tiki. So they're kind of, they're very unusual. They're very frequency-based. And you can play them while you're on the computer, cooking, cleaning. Like, you don't have to sit still because, you know, people will say to me, well, I don't want to sit still for 24 minutes, you know. Well, then you don't have to.
Now, where did you – how did you learn about all this stuff?
Yep. So 3 years ago, I live in Toronto, actually.
Oh, okay.
So I went to a yoga show, and there was 200 vendors. I had an hour. I found it in the first 5 minutes.
Wow.
And so I was about 44 at the time. And I'd experienced a lot of stuff in my life. Toronto's kind of a dense city, so it's kind of interesting at times. And I walked up. I did a voice sample, just like we were talking about doing today. And I took them home. And I recognized in about 12 hours that things were changing. So don't laugh, but I cried for an hour and a half.
Okay, I'm not gonna laugh.
It's okay. But it was important for me because I'd stopped crying, right? I'd locked every emotion inside of me. So what happened was I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. It was kind of out there.
Right.
So I went to a group event. So I went and experienced these along with using the technologies that we haven't talked about where we can take sound and we amplify it by running it through coils and noble gases. So they're causing an energy field.
Yeah.
So I went and I hung out for like 3 hours. We did a group session and I kind of went, wow. And it felt right. It kind of got me excited. I found it fascinating. So I just pursued it more. And I ended up buying one of the technologies and putting it in my house. And I could see the difference it was making to me, my family, my life. Things were flowing more easily. I wasn't as scattered as I used to be. I was more focused. So I began to play with it. I just explored it with him. At another show, I kind of watched how people responded, and so I began to get engaged, and that was 3.5 years ago.
Wow. Now, what's this? There's a white, I got a white tube here that's hooked up to your phone. What is this white? It's like a white cylinder. You know, folks, they can look at the picture on the Facebook, but what is this white cylinder here?
So all of the technologies, this is a portable technology. So in this white cylinder, there's a specially hand-wound copper coil. And a tube of 5 noble gases.
Oh, wow.
So there's actually xenon, argon, helium, krypton, and neon. And then there's a few other, flower essences and stuff. So what happens is it's actually not my cell phone. It looks like one, but we use it as a player. So there's a very specific list of frequencies. So instead of plugging it into a headset like you would normally listen to music, you're plugging it into the coil.
Oh, it's like a speaker.
Right. Okay. It's an energetic speaker.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of frequencies. So what's happening is I'm playing a clearing track right now, trying to get rid of low vibrational energies. I mean, some of that is just from Wi-Fi and EMF and that kind of stuff. There's concentrations to help us focus better, digestion frequencies, heart opening frequencies. So there's a whole playlist.
Yeah.
And the concept for the portable is that you actually keep it with you. So I've actually taken it on an airplane.
Oh, wow.
I keep it with me when I'm driving in the car, that kind of stuff. And
it's
helps
playing
me
now, but I can't really hear. Is it because it's loud in the room? Or?
No, it's not intended to be heard. Oh. It's about actually creating energy. So sound is really powerful when we hear it, like music, right? Think of how engaging music can be. So what was discovered, though, is when you push sound through a coil, whether it be in a portable one or a larger one, they're creating this beautiful, coherent energy field that's designed to do various things. So the sound is not as important as the energy. Energy goes deeper.
Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of the premise.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
Can we do a thing? Can we do me?
Yeah, I'd love to.
All right. I'll shut off my... Well, I don't know. Well, let's leave it on here. How do we do this?
So what I'll do is I'll put this here so you can keep your mic and you
all
can
right.
ask me questions.
Okay.
So basically, it's a silly phrase.
Mm-hmm.
The vowel sounds, A-E-I-O-N-U with B's and H's in front of it. So I'll get you to do a bit of a practice run, and then we'll do the real deal.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay.
So
cool.
I just read this. Okay. Yeah. Bay, bee, bye, bo, boo. Hey, he, hi, ho, who.
Yep, perfect. So this time, he can.
Thank you. All right.
The other hand, you're going to hold this one.
Okay, now I hold this mic. All right.
Really close to your mouth.
How close? Like this close?
That's good. Yep.
All right.
And now this time when you say it, you're going to keep saying it over and over until I say stop.
All right.
And do it more like we're having a conversation than monitoring.
Okay, you just coach me and let me know when.
Ready?
Okay,
you
all right.
Go for it, and I'll just tell you when to stop.
All right.
Go for it.
Okay. Bay, bee, bye, bo, boo. Hey, he, hi, ho, who. Bay, bee, bye, bo, boo. Hey, he, hi, ho, who. Bay, bee, bye, bo, boo. Hey, he, hi, ho, who.
Everybody right. always makes wants to finish.
Yeah, yeah, it's like
you're
OCD.
It always stops in the middle, and you're like, okay.
All right, so now you've got my sample.
Taking your sample, and what it does is it goes in and it analyzes your sample. And what we're going to do is I'm just going to save your sample because sometimes the computer likes to give me a little bit of heat just in case you disappear on me. So these are all the different places we've traveled.
Oh, wow.
We actually have we travel Canada.
Nice.
Sharing this and finding where it resonates for people. So just your first name.
Tim.
Ted.
No, Tim.
Tim.
I am, yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry.
And then we save samples because if people actually listen to their frequencies, generally they'll see, feel and observe changes in their life over time.
Really?
And we'll see the changes in their chart. So this is, holy God, a beautiful voice chart.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a beautiful voice chart, folks.
You guys see this.
Wow, she's calling over her partner here to check it out.
Bill.
She's calling Bill over. Apparently, Bill, I've got a top-notch voice chart.
You have a
very powerful being, hon.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, nice.
Very sensitive being at the same time.
Yeah. That's so amazing. So we'll go through this, and then if you wanted, you can let me know. Then I would create a CD. Or we can upload it onto a server, and you can download your frequencies to listen to. So I could actually play them right now if you want. Yeah.
Whoa, interesting.
I could actually play them right now. So what we'll do is I'll start creating the CD, and you can choose to listen or not, and then I'll tell you what I see.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
And you can welcome to take a picture.
You
can also
put it on a
server, and you can download it, too.
Of this thing here. There we go. That's good, yeah.
Yeah, hon, you're...
All right, interesting.
Okay, so I'll give you some of what it normally shows.
Hey, you want to take a picture of us, you know?
Take a picture of us, baby.
Take a picture of us doing this, so, you know. All right, interesting stuff.
Kind of like pretending like you're into it.
What's that?
Kind of like pretending you're into it.
I am into it. I'm interested in this. This is cool.
Interesting. All right, so I'm just going to grab this.
Yeah, we can get that out of here. Here we go. Yep.
That's all I need. So basically, basically,
I'll be able to edit all these at home anyway. Clean it up. So all
you
this,
do
yeah.
You want.
There you go.
I'm
all right.
Easy, huh?
No, I know.
Okay, not literally.
Ah, oh, no. Okay.
So it breaks it into kind of like a symphony. The first octave in your piano or your chart or your symphony is your physical body, and so. Height doesn't matter as much as balanced. We're going for balance here.
Yeah.
So the computer will analyze the peaks and the valleys and say, okay, what specific frequencies does Tim need to help harmonize so that he flows better?
I see what you're saying.
Right?
Yeah.
Does that help?
It makes sense, yeah.
So the first one is your physical body. And we don't do a lot of time analyzing the physical at all. The only thing that's interesting that we generally have seen is this one spike here.
Yeah, that's a big spike.
Is a big spike. Generally tends to mean that you're fighting a bit of an infection right now.
I am hungover.
That would work.
All right. That would make sense.
So the body's working in overdrive a little bit,
okay.
Trying to help you in some way.
All right.
I've never tested it when I have a hangover. I'm doing that next time.
Yeah. That might be the key.
Other times I've never thought to test it when I've had too many.
I was in my cups last night. We'll put it that way. Yes.
I understand. So that's kind of what it is. So the body's energetically working to help balance that right now.
Okay, that makes sense.
So the frequencies are designed to assist in the rebalancing. So there's the next one is your emotional energy body. And so, you know, notice you don't have the same spikes, but you've got a few. The most dominant is what in an area what we call the G-sharp. So tends to be that in your emotional energy body, there's stories or patterns or beliefs. Sometimes focused around you're spreading yourself too thin, potentially right now. May not see yourself as important. And you may have moments where you swing from low self-esteem to really big highs.
Okay.
You're really powerful,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Then you kind of dive and disappear, I call it.
Yeah, and that's this line here.
This
that's
one
a
here.
One. Yeah,
yep.
All right, interesting.
The other one that I'll pull out is kind of the C and the C-sharp in your emotional. So it's kind of, you know, maybe struggling a little bit with survival. Might be secretly hard on yourself. You don't necessarily share that with others. You may struggle with low energy, which is kind of consistent with this spike. I would also say self-power issues, really being the real you, expressing yourself. So then you go to the mental body, which is interesting because the spike in your emotional body is the same as your mental. So that's not always common.
Right.
So it means you're also thinking a lot, right, about issues, about potentially creativity.
Mm, okay.
Criticism, kind of sensitive to it is how, so you think a lot about it. Struggling to make choices. And might struggle a little bit with addictive behaviors.
Oh, yes. Okay. These are all hitting.
Hitting home.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yep. And I don't even need to know, which is the best part, right? So.
Now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
It's all big here. And it goes, is there a reason why these are like so little?
So, yeah, no, it's a great question. It's common in 99% of the charts for it to kind of do this.
Okay, yeah.
In fact, in your chart, the reason that I'm, you know, thinking, wow, what a powerful chart, is I actually don't see the height you have.
Wow.
Yeah,
nice.
I mean, most people in the tail end of the chart, we barely get a reading.
Oh, really?
You got a lot of presence, is how I would describe it. So this next block, which you think is small, is actually quite powerful. And it's about your spiritual journey, your soul's journey, depending on your beliefs pattern. And the largest spike is questioning why you're here in the first place.
At the what is
your,
or
no,
life?
Your life. What is your journey, right? And following that journey, what's that passion? The other big spoke, again, is around the throat. You got a lot of things to speak about, honey. And so so there's a little bit of you, we call it learning to surrender to your personal will, to your actual journey, connecting to the soul, getting beyond the mind, and following that real journey. Also, trying to discern would be the word, truth over deception.
Ah, okay.
If that makes sense
that makes
to
sense,
you.
Makes sense, yeah.
The other spike is around the heart, learning to let go, trust, and accept unconditional love from others.
Okay.
It's as though you may not trust, and so you're blocking. Your journey is to let go and love.
All right.
That's how I would say that.
Okay. Interesting.
This last one is amazing. This last one, we kind of call it, you know, what are your guidance tools to figure out your journey and what the heck you're supposed to be doing? And, I mean, you have a number of them, but there's three predominants. One is gut instinct. You're getting a gut instinct, you know, those guttural moments. You're like, yeah, I got to go for it, man.
Yeah.
Those are your guidance tools. Those are the ones you're supposed to be following, not your head.
Okay.
The other is your heart. If something opens your heart, makes you feel more passionate, more excited, that is your guidance map to go for it. May not be what you expect the result to be, but that's kind of your journey. The other is you are intuitive. Intuitive to me means you are getting, it could be thoughts, pictures, everybody absorbs it differently, feelings. I'm a feeler, so it's hard for me to put into words, about what you should do. It doesn't come from the head, does not a logical decision. It's like, oh, shit, that's what I should be doing. So you've got those gifts. Your trick is to use them more. Less head, more gifts.
Okay.
So what the computer's gone in and done, right, is looked at those patterns within you and produced a 24-minute set of frequencies.
Wow.
They're interesting. I can play them for you, just so you get a sample. But they're basically a minute long and then a break, a minute long and a break. And they'll change. They go from high to low to wiki-wiki. Like, they're very different. But the more you're willing to listen to these, what it's going to do is pick up on some of those underlying patterns that we just talked about, because they're typically associated with experiences or stories that have been ingrained in our being, that really would be so much nicer if we could let go of that shit. That's what this is doing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, who came up with all this stuff?
Yep, that's a great question. So a gentleman by the name of Robert Loy, originally Canadian, now lives in the U.S. Him and his beautiful partner, Helena Riley. This will be the culmination of 40 years plus of this life's work, where he began experimenting with sound, also in water and in technology. So what you're seeing is really the coming together in the last, say, 5+ years of all these different things to help people let go and move forward in their lives in a very different way.
Yeah.
She's a little ahead of her time, as one might say. But, they're in their 60s. They're beautiful, beautiful people.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I think, what else? You got a place you got a website or anything you want to direct people to?
Sure. It's a couple of things. You can learn more by going onto the website, clearlyconscious.ca. You know, Bill and I travel the country. We're actually doing an event in Nova Scotia while we're here, and we'll be back.
Nice.
So you can always just sign up and say, yeah, I want to know when you're coming back. So we do group events, fairly inexpensive.
Have you been down to America yet?
We have not, but there's a number of people sharing it in the U.S. My partner's been to Norway, Denmark, and all over, and in Canada.
Nice.
We just haven't been, we would say, called or led. We've been just hanging in Canada. Yeah.
All right. There you go. All right, Andrea. Well, thank you very much. This is really interesting stuff, and I'm going to I'll give it a listen and let you know how it goes.
Okay. I'd love that.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Oh, yeah.
There's one of a horse.
I see a horse here. There's a lot of horses. Here's one of a very very erotic drawing of a woman.
And another.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're here at the East Coast Paracon, and we're talking with an old friend of ours, and I was thinking about it outside. 10 years ago, this past April, we were in a very similar situation for my first ever interview, and I harassed you and harangued you and got you to sit just like this. It's like deja vu, 10 years later, and we're doing another conversation here with our good friend and hero to the program, Stan Friedman, of course, the star of the holiday special. And I don't even know where to begin. How have you been since we talked to you in December?
Well, I had no more glimmers of a heart problem, so I seem to have recovered fully from that. You know, I had a heart attack last June, 2014, and they put in my stents, and I haven't had a problem since. Stents problem since. and I've been traveling around, and... I've been busy. I'm thinking about another book. Kathleen Martin and I are talking about another one.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward. I'm going to be in Portland for a conference coming up. I'll be in Exeter for their 50th anniversary special. And I'm going to be at the MUFON conference, and I'm going to England.
Awesome, awesome. Now, one thing I really enjoyed your presentation, and what I was wondering, having seen it, was... You mentioned how it was in all these papers. Roswell was in all these papers after it happened. How did it end up kind of falling? You know, and obviously there was no internet back then, so you know people wouldn't have found it. But how did this story end up falling through the cracks for so long until it reemerged? You know, in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, it only reemerged because I got lucky when I was interviewed and somebody mentioned it who knew Jesse Marcel. And it wouldn't have reemerged. And the kicker was that once you start looking, you found that it was in lots of newspapers in a very narrow time frame, though.
Just like a couple days.
Yeah, a couple days, yeah. That's it. I mean, they put the kibosh on it so quickly. The California, Los Angeles Herald Examiner, I think it is, they had both stories, the Army captures flying saucer, and General says it's radar weather gadget, and the same issue because of the time zone,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
So, and that was, look, the original story came out too late to make it to the East Coast papers. It only came out from Chicago West. The cover-up story made it into all the papers.
Okay.
So that was the end of it. You know, no big deal. You'll find Frank Edwards' book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, mentions Roswell in a paragraph and got most of the information wrong. And the NICAP put out a 1947 wave book about all the sightings in 47. And they have one paragraph, and again, he only looked at the cover-up stories, not at the original story. So it wasn't any place where people would know about it. And I was just lucky. I mean, once you have a date and you know where to look, then you can find stories. But living in Canada, it's not easy to get American newspapers from special dates anyway,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But so it stayed out of the gutter until I got involved. And that wasn't until 1978.
Right.
And, you know, right now I've got a DVD here, Recollections of Roswell, more than 20 first-hand witnesses and their testimony. They're all dead.
Right.
So you can't go back and, you know, find all these people. So it's just, I just got lucky. Actually, I was steered into it twice. Lydia Sleppy, there was a guy in California, forest ranger. I was living out there and heard about his sighting and talked to him with Bobby N. Slate, who was a co-author on some magazine articles that I did. And he said he had a good sighting, a forest ranger, so he had a good view of the world,
yeah, nice.
You know.
Yeah.
He said, you really ought to talk to my mom. She had a great sighting in Albuquerque. Okay, Lydia Sleppy lived in Albuquerque and called her. And I don't know how we got onto it, but she told about her sighting, which was a good case. And then she mentioned this story about their Roswell affiliate radio station.
Mm-hmm.
She worked at a radio station in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And she'd been called, their Albuquerque station had been called by the Roswell affiliate. And the guy wanted, they didn't have a connection to the newswire. AP or whatever it was. But the Albuquerque station did. So she called to dictate a story. She was called. And she wasn't a reporter. She was a typist and you know, the things. But
there's like calling and saying, get us on the wire kind of thing.
Yeah. And so the guy is talking about there was a crash and it was the wreckage was going to be sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And then she reports that there was a bell went off, and it said, discontinue this transmission, which was she'd never had that happen. So she told the guy on the other end, what do I do? He said, stop. And so I talked to her, got as many names as she could remember. I mean, this is, you know, more than 30 years later and stuff. And I followed as fast as I could, as much as I could. I followed up on it. But I could only get so far, and, well, I don't remember was the response, or, you know. I remember vaguely, but I no specifics and so forth. And I finally gave up on it. So I was ready, in a sense, for when I heard the Jesse Marcel story.
Yeah.
But I couldn't resist on Jesse. I mean, because of his position.
Right, right.
You know, as the intelligence officer for the only atomic bombing group in the world, that's somebody you want to listen to.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And then I got, you know, I must admit, I got lucky. I mean, I called the newspaper, asked for the, this is in 78, asked for the editor from 47, long gone, what do you need? I tell her, well, I've got some articles here. It says the base public information office. I didn't even know the base had been closed years before this call. I said, a guy named Walter Howe taught, his name is spelled four different ways. And the most shocking statement imaginable, his wife works here.
What?
Well, the guy's from Chicago. He was there in 47, and based there.
Stuck around.
He loved it there, raised his family there and all that sort of thing. But it was a total shock, you know. And Walter, and I talked to the wife, and then I talked to Walter, and then he had a copy of the base yearbook, which helped.
One thing leads to another. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he was very helpful. And I did a lot of checking on Walter, talked to people in town casually, you know, this guy and stuff. And I only heard good things about Walter. And, you know, small towns, people have reputations. I mean, they can be bad or they can be good.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And Walter's were good. And he had sold insurance, and that usually means pretty trustworthy because people won't buy from somebody they don't trust. And he managed an art gallery, too. So that was very lucky. And the other thing I was lucky about, I called information and asked if there was anybody named Brazel, the rancher's last name. And the gal says, in what town? I said, I don't know, just southeastern New Mexico. Okay, well, she looked. She said, oh, I've got a Bill Brazel in Carrizozo. I had no idea where that was, so I asked her, is that in southeastern New Mexico? And she said, yes. Well, it turns out, I was working closely with Bill Moore at that time, and he had tried to find a Brazel like 3 weeks earlier. And would you believe he hadn't been listed yet? He didn't have his phone yet.
Oh, wow.
So I got lucky in my timing.
Right, exactly.
So you got lucky is the point you were making.
Yeah. I mean, luck happens to those who are waiting for it.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
If I hadn't made the attempts. But and there were other things along the way. But mostly, you got to be persistent. And that's the thing that I've been to 20 archives, some of them many times, like the Eisenhower Library and Truman Library, places like that. And it's kind of funny. A lot of papers are at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division in Washington. And General Twining's papers were there. Well, the first time I went there many years ago, most of it was classified. You just get, it's not there, you know, not accessible. And I would ask for declassification or three or four boxes. And the next time I go back, they'd gone through them, and mostly stuff was declassified. And I finally, it was not the first, second, or third time, but I think the fourth time I finally found his flight log was in one of those boxes. I didn't know that. But it's nice to have confirmation of who was going where when.
Right, right.
When I say, in the Majestic 12 document, for example, it says that Twining flew to New Mexico on July the 7th, 1947. Well, I got his flight log, and I can prove it.
Yeah.
And when he left and so forth. Then I had found his pilot's flight log, too. I found his pilot, his daughter. He asked family members things, and she was helpful. The daughter was helpful. Not only telling me his pilot's name, and that he lived in the Washington, D.C. area, so the next time I was there, I called, and
yeah.
And there he was, and met with him, and he let me copy his flight log. She also told me that General Spatz, who was Air Force Chief of Staff in those early days, I had his desk calendar, and supposedly he was in Port Aransas. Now, he was based up in the Seattle area at the time. And I couldn't find Port Aransas up there. So I asked Twining's daughter, and she mentioned, oh, that's down on the Gulf Coast. exactly, not far from Corpus Christi.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, the Air Force generals, a lot of them would gather together and fishing. Well, the pilot had told me they liked to talk to each other when there was nobody around.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so fishing is a good idea. Well, to verify that, I called the Corpus Christi newspaper, and I said, for this week, July something to something, you got any articles about General Spatz? Unusual name, so easy to find. And it turns out one of his people was a fisherman. There was a picture of him having caught a large fish. And it fit right in that time frame, so clearly he was there. In one of the phony MJ-12 documents, it said something about his meeting with Twining on a certain date in a certain place, and I could prove that he didn't. Mm. He was someplace else.
Right, right.
And certainly the newspaper article saying that his first officer, whatever he was there is pretty good evidence. So it takes persistence and it takes luck, but one of the things is that you sort of race in the Undertaker
with the Roswell,
stuff. I mean, people die. Like, what can I say? I'm going to die too. So, well, I mean,
I know, no, it's just.
You mean you can't find somebody? I said, no, he died. You know? Sorry, but at least I did talk to an awful lot of firsthand people, and I think that's important. That you not just depend on A said, B said, C said.
Right, right.
You know.
And it's documented, and it's like on the record now. You know.
Yeah, and it's like Twining. I paid somebody to check the Alamogordo newspaper for this period of time, and sure enough, the front of the paper had articles covering up, explaining away the disc. Hmm. And I believe these were General Twining's people.
Yeah.
And so it made sense, but clearly they made an effort, and he was running the show.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like with Dr. Donald Menzel of Harvard. I had to get his wife's permission to look at his papers at Harvard, plus two other people. And so he never told her anything classified. That's not what I was looking for. But to discover, to my total shock, that he had a longer continuous connection with the National Security Agency, he told Jack Kennedy in a letter.
Yeah.
So I've got that in writing, you know, from him. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. Menzel saying to the president.
Wow.
Well, they knew each other, and so I was able to find out stuff. But and I get people give me a hard time about Menzel. He was a debunker. How could he be part of this crazy MJ-12 group? Well, okay, he was doing stuff nobody knew he was doing. But I was able to show that he had been a world-class cryptographer. He knew Kennedy not only on a first-name basis, but tells him, you know, he can tell him more about the NSA and stuff like that. And people who say it couldn't be, I try to make them aware that we have many examples of people who led double lives.
Right.
Just because he was a debunker, what better choice for a debunker than somebody who really knows the truth?
Exactly,
and to stay away from the truth, you know.
Because he would know who needed to be gone after the hardest.
Yeah, and so people want to do their research by proclamation. I prefer investigation.
There you go. For rules of for debunkers, right?
Yeah. Well, it's important to me because I get, MJ-12 is a good example, I get people attacking all kinds of details that they really didn't know what they were talking about. And it's not just Phil Klass who talked about the Pica type, proved that the one document was a fraud. Nonsense. He'd never been, I found out, I checked, he'd never been to the Eisenhower Library. And he's telling you that the National Security Council only used elite type. He had 9 documents to prove it. Well, they've got 250,000 pages of NSC stuff there.
Right, right.
9 to 250,000 is not a good sampling.
Yeah.
You know. So and I got other people, and I, about Menzel, I know of nobody who's gone to his papers to look at them before they complained that he couldn't have been.
Right.
And damn it, don't tell me what you theorize or what you believe. Give me some evidence, facts, data. And so, to me, it's a challenge. But the MJ-12 papers explain something that really needs explanation. The Bolander memo, General Carol Bolander, Air Force General, who was an engineer in the Lunar Excursion Module, had nothing to do with Project Blue Book. And in 1969, because the Condon people said, we should close Project Blue Book, it's not contributing anything, and I agree with that. So Bolander, who had worked on the Lunar Excursion Module, we landed in July. I do believe we landed on the moon. And he was asked to come up with a recommendation. And so he wrote a memo, which we didn't see for 10 years. It was a classified memo to begin with. And I think it was inadvertently released with a bunch of papers that Bob Todd had requested. So they, you know, sent him all this stuff. And I think that got in there when it shouldn't have. But anyway, in it he said something very extraordinary. He said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Now, that's an extraordinary statement, because we've been told for all these years that Blue Book was it. And two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. So we're going to, if we close Project Blue, we'll still be investigated.
Right.
Well, but of course, the Air Force has been saying since it was closed as a result of that memo, that that's it, ain't nothing more, forget about it. So I called, as far as I know, I'm the only one who talked to Bolander in the UFO research community. I like looking for people with unusual names.
So I guess so, yeah.
Bolander's a lot easier than Smith.
yeah, I was thinking that when you were doing the presentation. You lucked out that that you didn't run into any Smiths or anything like that.
Oh, boy. So I called him. Very nice gentleman, and I explained that I'd had a clearance for 14 years, been interested in the subject, found his memo quite fascinating. And so he'd understand that I knew about security and stuff like that. And I said, it sounds to me like you're saying that there were two separate communication channels. One for the stuff that could affect national security. And I gave him an example. I said, I just heard about a case where saucer went down the runway as Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored. By definition, that's a matter for national security. You can't avoid that. I said, another... wise, if my wife and I are going down the street and see a saucer fly over, big deal. Yeah. It happens all the time. And he agreed with me, yes, two separate channels of communication. Well, the question is, so where did those reports which could affect national security go if they didn't go to Project Blue Book? MJ-12 provides the perfect answer. And it answers another question. I have been wondering about why we don't get Navy reports. Several years ago, I had talked to somebody in the Navy History Office. No, we don't have anything about UFOs. So I sent him a report that had been jointly authored by Air Force Intelligence and Naval Intelligence. Thank you for the interesting report, but as I told you, we have nothing. Now, ONI is the oldest of the military intelligence agencies. It's got a great reputation. The Navy covers the world, obviously.
Right.
So, where the hell are their reports? And I filed an Information Act request, and we don't have anything. This is recent. Mm-hmm. And I had just had a wonderful report from a former guy in the Coast Guard, went into service. A whole bunch of guys on one of the Coast Guard ships out in the Pacific had a very good sighting, and a report was filled out and sent somewhere. They don't know where. And so I contacted the ONI, after getting this negative response. They were polite. They were very nice. And she looked me up on the internet and was interested. I couldn't send her one of my books because they can't accept that kind of stuff. But she was interested. But it seems to me you'd only need one central office for Army, Navy, Air Force reports, which could affect national security.
Right.
Why would you set up three independent groups? It's not a public office.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and you can say, well, what would these guys do? Well, they would look at radar measurements, for example. They would look at close encounters. They would look at where people have made measurements or taken pictures with the instrumentation on board an aircraft chasing a UFO. Well, there's technical analysis required here. Well, why would you set up three offices
to do that? Right.
You know, it makes no sense. So the obvious place is that they went to Operation Majestic 12.
Seems to make sense. Now, well, it's interesting. We talk. You mentioned, you know, the race with the Undertaker and everything. It's this year. Roswell had this sort of I don't know what to call it. It was back in the news, let's say, with the slides and everything. So I mean, I'm sure that yeah. Well, I guess are you? I'm sure. Oh, okay. Well, you can tell me that. But are you ever surprised that? Were you surprised that? Oh, this is like the people are still kind of trying to take advantage of the Roswell mythos and. For their own ill-gotten gains, perhaps.
Some of that. I got invited by Jaime Maussan, and to his credit, because he's a newsman in Mexico City, and he has asked for people to submit videos, he's put together big collections UFO videos. So I give him credit for that. And I don't know how he got involved in these so-called Roswell slides. And he interviewed me in Arizona in February. And invited me to the conference. And I said, oh, I'll have to think about it. I'll tell you one thing. Considering the winter Fredericton has had this past year, last year, a trip to Mexico City sounded like a great idea, you know. But everything I'd looked up for about these slides, I couldn't find anything that linked them with Roswell.
Right, right.
It's an interesting slide. I don't know what's in it, but not,
even if you just take the obviously I'm not a believer that it's an alien body in the slide. But even if you had that, it has no like you're saying it has no discernible connection to Roswell.
Well, and also one of the things that bugged me is I can't believe any self-respecting scientist would have put an alien body on display. Apparently at room temperature, there's no indication of there's refrigeration or anything. I mean, talk about valuable biological specimens. Mm. You'd keep it around because your technology improves your ability to. We couldn't measure DNA
years,
and we didn't know how to do that.
Right, right.
And other tests on things. And I found an analogous thing when I was in industry looking at liquid metal-cooled nuclear reactors. You can transfer a lot of heat. But they had a problem when they were using sodium-potassium alloy. Sometimes it would corrode the metal, and sometimes it wouldn't. But they couldn't measure what was in the fluid very accurately. When they finally pinned down a way to accurately measure the amount of oxygen in the fluid, it turns out that was the difference, but until you could measure that,
you
couldn't tell. So I can't believe with something like a biological specimen like that.
Yeah, like a once-in-a-lifetime Earth.
Yeah, you're going to keep that around, and any new technique that comes along, you're going to try to use it. So that was one thing that bugged me. It's on a shelf?
Yeah.
You know, with a display card next to it? Come on. You know, that didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So I finally said no, and I was pleased that at least Don Schmidt apologized. Mm. Now, there undoubtedly will be more discussion in September at the MUFON conference, because I'm scheduled to speak there, but Jaime is also scheduled to speak there, not about this.
Oh, okay.
He's showing videos. Mm. But this question is going to come up. There's no getting around it. I talked to the head of MUFON, and, you know, where do we go from here? So I'm sure there'll be more discussion, and what can I say? Maybe it'll encourage somebody else to come forward with real stuff. I don't know. But you're right in the initial presumption that it clearly indicates that people are interested, or there wouldn't have been this furor about this.
Yeah, it
certainly became a topic of conversation. And, you know, you can't control what goes on. And I will give Jaime credit for collecting lots of videos. He really has, because he's a major newsman in a major city, and he showed that if you ask people to supply him, you'll dig it out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
I had a problem like that. I did a program up in Seattle by phone, radio program, and the woman hostess said something like, well, how come there aren't any sightings around here? And I said something to the effect that, well, I'm sure there are. You just won't hear about them. I'll bet if you ask people to report their sightings, you'd get, oh, I don't think so, she said. And I said, well, why don't you try it? So we went to commercial, and when we came back, she asked people to. And the phone lines were flooded with people with sighting reports. I know, because I've been out there. I know that happens. Look, at all my lectures, at the end of my lecture, I ask how many people here believe they've seen a flying, what I would describe as a flying saucer. And typically it's 10%, and they're all surprised. And then I ask how many reported what you saw. 90% of the hands go down.
Right.
So, you know, there's a difference between getting a report and people seeing something. So the public side of this question is interesting, because I spoke at a college class a few years ago. The instructor asked the students in the class before I got there what they thought about UFOs, and 80% thought most people didn't believe in them, and 80% of that group did. So the reality, the perception of the reality is very different, and the reality itself.
Yeah.
So there's an enormous resource out there that hasn't been tapped, the Navy intelligence, and just the public in general. And what is interesting to me is that the data from Kepler has excited a lot of people.
Right.
Because there seem to be planets all over the darn place out there. Now, it will be interesting to see what happens with this big development of the Soviet billionaire, Yuri Murkin.
Oh, yeah. He's kind of...
He's going to spend $100 million dollars with the SETI people.
Right. I heard that, too.
Which I think is... what a waste.
Right.
But there's another side to that. And I'll sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I'm sure governments, Russian and the American, would much rather people were focused on radio and laser signals from out there than the flying saucer data, technology, and what do we have to do here to catch up, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So let them listen, But it would be nice if ufology got, 2% of that.
Right. You think you'd want to spread your money around to different ways to do it. If you're trying to solve a problem and there's different avenues to do it, you would try it different ways.
Well, Stephen Hawking was with him, and we have this interesting thing that Hawking has previously said, that we shouldn't send signals out because we'll let aliens know that we're here, and maybe there's some bad guys out there, like Columbus wasn't good for the Indians, and so forth. Yeah, the only trouble with that is that assumes if they can do us damage, they can get here. But he doesn't think there's anybody...
That's interesting. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That's sort of crazy logic. Now, wait a minute. What you're saying, they can't get here, so we should listen for signals. Then you're saying if they hear something, they might come here. Well, either they can or they can't.
A little bit there, yeah. I didn't even think of that.
And so the SETI people, they're... A few primary areas where they are totally ignorant. One is UFO evidence. You never find references in their books to the scientific studies on flying saucers. Right. Oh, we can't talk about that. The second thing that they know nothing about is government cover-up. You know, they're accustomed to, papers appear in scientific journals that are refereed, and that's where research data goes. And they can't imagine that anybody can cover anything up. Well, the government's covering up all the time.
Yeah.
It goes with the territory. You know, the 156 pages of NSA documents you can read one sentence on. Well,
yeah,
I call that a cover-up,
exactly,
you know.
Yeah.
Or the dozens of CIA documents about UFOs, by their definition, that you can read a few words on a page. Or one of my favorite pages says, deny in toto.
Yeah.
Not one word you can read on that page. So, it's kind of weird that there is such general acceptance by the public. You talk to kids and their first response is, well, we can't be the only ones.
Right, right.
It wasn't too many years ago that people were saying we were the only one. Mm. This is the only solar system.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're the only planet that obviously is covered with civilization and water and stuff like that. You don't get many people saying that anymore.
Yeah, anyone who says, yeah. People who think that this, that we're alone are usually, you know, they're kind of written off as being living in the dark ages or something.
Yeah, yeah. And now I must admit that there's another aspect that intrigues me is what I call sort of an anti-nuclear bias. In all the coverage I read about Pluto,
right,
that's exciting. I mean,
it
takes almost 10 years to get there. It's a weird-looking place. But none of the coverage mentioned that the power supply was nuclear.
Oh, yeah, I didn't hear that.
There is a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, RTG. It's about a foot long and 8 inches in diameter. It's got 24 pounds of plutonium in it. And that emits alpha particles, which gets absorbed, raise the temperature, and there's a law of physics that shows if you got a temperature difference between two points, an electric current flows.
Yeah.
Thermoelectric. Okay. That darn thing's been running for almost 10 years, and it'll go for another 30 years.
Wow.
And I think people must think that it's probably solar power. But the solar intensity at Pluto is 1/1,000th of what it is here.
Pluto's
a good long ways away. You
I didn't even think about that until you mentioned that, how they power.
Did you hear any comments?
No, it was just news to me. And that I think about it, it's like, well, yeah, I didn't really even give it any thought. You know.
Well, all of our really deep space probes use radioisotope thermoelectric generators. They're very reliable. There's no moving parts.
Well, why do you think they just don't want people to know that, or why do you think it's just underreported, too confusing for them or something?
There is concern. The word nuclear bothers some people. It's kind of like the Cassini spacecraft, which is out at nosing around at Saturn, been there for years. We sent that in to go past Venus to get a free kick, cosmic freeloading,
I call it.
They came back past the Earth. Now, it had an RTG on it, and there were some people saying, oh, you're going to blow up the Earth if there's an accident when it comes back. Well, that isotope of plutonium is not fissionable. You can't make a bomb out of it. It's not cheap. This is not something you buy down at Walmart, plutonium. But, the other place where this shows up, this attitude, if you will, is when you get the SETI cultists talking about you can't get here from there. They keep talking about chemical rockets.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, wait a minute, guys. We've tested fission nuclear rockets on the ground very impressively. And there have been serious studies done of fusion for deep space propulsion.
Yeah.
And fusion is what produces almost all the energy in the universe, all the stars. That's the process. It's nuclear fusion. They're not burning gas up there.
I'm going to have to wrap it up because they're going to start rolling out. So I wanted to say thank you very much. I'm going to be hanging out with you tomorrow on the ride back to Halifax anyway, so I get some extra Stan time. So thank you very much for this and for everything you've done for the show, Stan. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What's going on?
Just they're hanging up there. Journals is the only guy here. I thought you might have been a ghost there.
I figured I scared you.
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get gonged in a minute here. I'm here with...
Phil Crosby.
There you go. There's no name on that. So no. Phil Crosby?
Yes.
All right. That's almost a little too close to Bill Cosby. But I think
it's Phil.
I think you'll survive. All right, now we showed the picture on Facebook. You got these four gongs. What is this all about?
It's all about sound healing, balancing your energy, helping your immune system kick in, and for you to heal yourself, essentially. But most people find it very relaxing. So, and if we find it relaxing, as I say, our immune system kicks in and our body does it for ourselves. But these three of these gongs are 38 inches across. They produce amazing vibration, and that can actually travel to a cellular level as well.
Really?
So, yeah. I can show you a demonstration with a water bowl. But if you think of ultrasounds, if you think of MRIs, that's all resonance bouncing off our body and taking measurements. This is actually sound waves that could actually travel in our bodies to our cells. And then we think about cell phones and the negative effect that they have. They're doing the exact same thing, but with a very negative effect.
Like a Wi-Fi in the air and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this is a harmonious, organic way to help your body recover, de-stress, and to heal.
Interesting. All right. Okay. How'd you come up with all this? How'd you hear about all this? How'd you get involved with all this?
About 10 years ago, went to a wellness show in Liverpool in the UK, where we're from, and literally was blown away. I'd done Reiki. I'd been into meditation since 2000 after the big motorcycle accident. That's how I initially got into it. And a guy there who looked not unlike myself with the shaved head, and he was a professional musician who'd got into sound healing, and he had gongs. They had planet gongs such as these, and once you hear them, it's like just blew me away. So
yeah. Well, these things are massive. So you came all the way from England with these gongs?
We brought four with us, and we've bought four since through the States. There's a supplier there, and they're made by Paiste, who make the drum kit cymbals.
Okay, yeah.
Like the Police, U2, Kings of Leon, all got them. They've been making gongs for over 100 years, and they're tuned to the frequency of planets. They're actually electronically tuned.
Wow. Yeah. How do you this is like completely like fourth wall breaking. How do you travel with all this stuff? Like, because this is huge.
In our
the
van.
Folks out.
In our van.
All right.
And that's why I say my wife married me. She just wanted a roadie.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to get gonged now. All right. We'll do it. Let's do it.
Cool.
All right, folks, I've been gonged. It was pretty awesome. It was pretty amazing. Now, what do you do? Because it's like, what's the technique a little bit? It's how you can't even really convey it on radio, but, you know.
That's
oh, wow.
Made of sheepskin.
And do you, like, just drag it across? You don't really,
no.
You don't bang it, do you?
Yeah, gently with them.
It's kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. I see, yeah. All right. Okay, that's interesting.
Now, these things, Tim.
Okay,
now
he's got
flumies.
Some small, so they look like lollipops.
Yeah, made of rubber. These are called flumies.
Yeah,
and
flumies.
And these things you do drag.
Okay.
So, you know those sounds that you maybe felt sound like whale sounds
or
whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
That's them. Just put your thumb behind it, drag it along the gong.
All right, let me see. Let's do this down here, yeah. All right. Now I'm going to do a flumie.
Yeah.
Okay, flumie drag. Wow, all right. Wow, see, yeah, because, yeah, it's amazing. It's really cool. You get bombarded with all these different, like, sound. It's like, it's really amazing. You know, you see the gongs and you think, just the stereotypical gong sound. But then as you're in there, when you're getting the gonged, it's like all you're bombarded with all these sort of different unique sounds. It's really amazing.
Different frequencies, and it's the overtones that they produce, Tim.
Yeah.
And as I said to you before, they're electronically tuned, so they will actually take your brain waves down to a delta and theta state, that the state of deep relaxation on the border of sleep, almost instantaneously because of the physical waves that they produce.
Okay.
And that's what you got bombarded with.
It was pretty awesome. Thank you very much, Phil. Any place you want to plug, any website or anything like that?
Yeah, just our website is soundbeings.com.
All right, soundbeings.com. Check it out, folks. Thank you very much, Phil.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
There he is. What's that?
You missed me.
That was you singing?
No, it was
I heard some singing. Oh.
When we went down through the staircase down below to the where the old jail used to be.
Where's the jail?
It used to be in front.
Can you see, does it like look like a jail?
No.
Wow.
No. But there's some really neat costumes down there where we were taken in from the other side.
Yeah, yeah, I saw. I think I went in there. Yeah, there's like a funky head. Yeah. Yeah, I saw a funky like head mask thing, and that's when I was like, okay, I think I'm gonna fuck.
but where? From up in there?
No, we went down the stairs, right?
Yeah.
And then
you can get in from down there, from this side, though.
You can get in from this side, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because that door's open.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I got it up to 3 at one point.
Did you?
A moment ago, but...
Where were you?
Right here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was kind of flickering at 1, and then it got up to 2, like, right about before you guys came out.
Here's a strange thing. I just took the girls up there, and we took a look at the props and all that that's up there, and came back. And a couple other guys wanted to go up forward.
Yeah.
Went to go back through the door. It's locked.
Really?
I was the last one through that door, and I can tell you that I didn't...
You didn't lock it?
No.
Weird. That's weird.
It's locked. You can't, like... From this side to go back in there, you can't.
That metal door up here?
Yeah.
Weird. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're here at the East Coast Paracon. I'm with Kelly Connolly. She's part of the Crossover
Paranormal Society,
and she's been a big part of putting this whole thing together, and last night she led the ghost hunt. People probably can see the pictures on the Facebook. So, Kelly, I guess just tell us a little bit about yourself. How'd you get mixed up in all this paranormal stuff?
I guess I've always had experiences most of my life, especially as a child, just didn't really know what they were. In the early teens, I read Helen Creighton's Blue Nose Ghost a couple dozen times, and was just fascinated with legends, lore, ghost stories, all that kind of stuff. I also have a nursing background. I've been a nurse for over 15 years and have witnessed, seen, experienced different things that have led me to be curious. And want to know more. And 2 years ago, I joined the Crossover Paranormal Society, and we've been on many investigations where things have happened that aren't explained.
There you go. See, you're natural. You'll be fine. Well, this is what one thing I found kind of interesting about the thing last night was the lights out part of it. I've never done a ghost hunt before, so what's the benefit of the lights out part? What's the impetus behind that whole aspect of the ghost hunt? Which I guess for folks who don't know what I'm talking about, they just turn out all the lights.
Yep.
So what's that all about?
Makes it more fun.
All right.
Yep. Personally, I think when lights are out, it makes all our other senses sharpen. So we can pick up on different things, feelings, sensations, maybe voices. Our eyes adjust to the darkness, and sometimes it's a little easier to see the shadows, different things like that. So, yep. Yeah.
Okay.
And especially the time of night, later in the evening, it just seems to be a less busy time of day when we can pick up on different things. We don't have all that background noise, traffic, et cetera, et cetera. Yep.
And so you think the lights out just kind of heightens the
the
moment, maybe makes the ghosts feel more at home, like, oh, maybe they left?
Yeah, could be. I've never asked them.
And what's some of the cool or strange stuff you've gotten from these ghost hunts? You told me a little bit about them last night, but for the folks listening at home, what kind of stuff have you picked up?
Audio is our best evidence. So we carry audio recorders, so they're going during the entire investigation. Afterwards, we listen to the audio with headsets, and we pick up voices. Some things would be considered residual, so something that would happen time and time again. Other things are seem more intelligent. Because we divide up into different groups and do different areas and then switch it up, we know where our members are at all times. We know when we're on a break. We know that if those voices are there, they're not ours, then it's unexplained.
All right. Now, you said last night you don't really get scared on these things. So that's a...
Unless they're spiders.
Unless they're spiders, yeah.
Spiders.
Yeah. So what's your, do you have a favorite, give me like a favorite memory or moment from one of these things. Give me a little tale for the listeners. Maybe the one about the lady. That's a good one. That's
a
good one.
Okay. Right. Yep. So we did an investigation. It was an undisclosed site. It was a business around the turn of the 1900s. One of the rules there was that you weren't supposed to talk much at all. And actually, Clark, Linda Rayfuse's husband, was accompanying me on this investigation. And as we left the first story, heading up the stairs to the second story of this building, I heard a woman's voice in my ear. And I turned around to Clark and I said, "Did you hear that?" So you could clearly hear me on audio ask him that question. We didn't pick up that voice in audio, but immediately after I said that, there's a woman's voice that says, "Don't talk so loud."
Pretty spooky stuff.
Spooky, or she knows me, one or the other.
But Clark, he didn't hear any of this.
No, he was behind me. He didn't hear the woman's voice, but the other voice telling me not to talk so loud was definitely audible in our audio. And it was me, Clark, and another woman with us. So it wasn't her, it wasn't me. Pretty sure it wasn't Clark's voice. So, again, it's unexplained. We never go in saying this is what it is or this is what it isn't. We go in, we do an investigation, we take digital pictures, we do audio, we do K2 meters, we use night vision cameras, trail cams, that sort of thing. Whatever we can explain, we explain. Whatever's left, we give to the client, and they can do with that what they want.
Now, these are just people who, like, want you to come check out a location, right?
Yeah, so they've either had experiences or they want validation, or we've done quite a few businesses. We've done the Galley Restaurant in Chester twice. Ben and Jeff are wonderful people down there. They've got some of our evidence uploaded on their website, so that's quite a hot spot. So people are just curious and they call us in. We go in, we spend a couple hours walking around, asking questions in the dark, taking pictures. And then spend a good amount of time reviewing it all.
Yeah. It sounds like it's quite the undertaking. No pun intended.
Yeah, no. It is quite an undertaking. But again, it's a passion. We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't really enjoy it. Especially staying out on a Saturday night until about 2 or 3 in the morning. So, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of got the impression just last night because someone gave me the K2 thing. I was telling you, and it's like once it starts to go a little bit, it's like fishing or something. It can get kind of addictive. I'm up to 3.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. You're like, no, come back.
Yeah.
Come on, you know?
And then light it up to red. So, and especially when you do a scan and you realize there's not being affected by electrical fields, and it kind of comes and goes, or it responds to you. So when I was asking it to come a little closer, light it right up to red, and it does that, it's kind of interesting. I'm the only member of the group, and they'll all tell you I keep my investigation equipment in my purse, so 24/7. I guess I'm a ghost hunter, ghost investigator at heart.
Have you ever, like, busted it out on your own, just like you're somewhere and you're like, all right, I got a weird feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's probably why I keep it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you get, like, an EVP? You ever got, like, an EVP on your own or anything weird like that?
I don't usually use my audio recorder a lot, but I will use my K2 meter if I pick up on something or if I am just curious, that sort of thing. But you just never know when it might come in handy, so, yeah, it's always in my purse.
Yeah. Now, I've been a part of a few of these different events, kind of in the same role you are, sort of, being part of the organizers and stuff. And I know, I'm sure you'll have more thoughts, in the days and weeks to come. But what's your, having almost wrapped up the weekend here, what's your initial thoughts on what it's like to put together one of these events and be a part of the folks, that make it all happen?
Well, it's been a little over a year in the making. We've got quite a few on the people on the organizing committee. I think overall it's been a great success. Feedback from the keynote speakers, our guests, people participating in the conference, feedback is all really good. So feedback sheets are really important. We'll take that and read them over, see how we can improve things, see what worked, see what didn't. And again, Best Western here in Liverpool has been great. They've bent over backwards for us. So I think overall it's been a very successful weekend.
Yeah. It's been quite the weekend. I just want to say thank you, Kelly, and thank you to all the folks, behind the whole event for having me up here, give me the press pass, let me run wild and have some fun up here in Liverpool. It's been quite the weekend, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. We're glad to have you here, and glad you could join us last night on the ghost hunt. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Kelly.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
All right, thanks, Barry. Hey, you staying at the hotel?
Yeah.
All right. I might need a ride.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I don't think I can give you one. I got a little roadster.
I'll find someone to give me a ride.